Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. It is National Heart Month, and that has less to do with Valentine's Day and romance than it does with heart health. Heart disease is still the world's biggest killer. It's the leading cause of death in the U.S. But there is much that can be done to deal with it in the areas of prevention, diagnosis, and treatment. New and improved diagnostic techniques, drugs, and surgical capabilities are saving lives every day. I'm Don Marsh. Heart disease is what we're talking about on today's program. Joining me in studio is Dr. Andrew Cates. He's a cardiologist with Washington University's Heart Care Institute at Barnes Jewish Hospital and Washington University's Cardiology Fellowship Program Director. Dr. Michael Lim is a cardiologist with SLU Care and co-director for Comprehensive Cardiovascular Care at St. Louis University Hospital. Gentlemen, thanks very much for being with us. Nice to see you.
Nice to be here. Thanks for having us.
Dr. Cates, I'll begin with you. We've done this program at about this time of year, right, every year for recent history.
I like the new digs.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. We do, too. Let me begin by asking you, since we last talked about a year ago, what have you seen in the way of improvement, if you will, advances in diagnosis, prevention, techniques, that sort of thing?
So that's a great question. And with even over the last year, we're continuing to reevaluate risk factors for cardiovascular disease. I think actually before we get to what's new, I think it's going to be helpful just to remind the listeners too, when we talk about cardiovascular disease, just what we're talking about, and coronary disease as well. And remember that cardiovascular disease includes stroke, coronary artery disease, peripheral vascular disease, and such. And I think, as you alluded to just a few minutes ago, too, how important cardiovascular disease and coronary artery disease is as well. And we think about that, the statistics are overwhelming, as you know, that about 715,000 Americans have a heart attack each year, and about 600,000 die annually, and it's about one out of four deaths. As you alluded to also, that a lot of this is preventable. We know about 90% of the risk factor, 90% of the risk factors for a heart attack are preventable. When it comes to what's new, I think we're learning again every day that there are steps that we can take to further prevent heart disease, looking at risk factors, some of the traditional risk factors, and some of the emerging risk factors as well.
All right. Dr. Lim, let me put the question to you. I know that you probably have seen some advances in recent months or even years, but more likely recent months. What are you seeing?
Well, that's we like to be optimistic, right? So, so that's where your question is based. And what's new and what's great, and how are we going to get not only the nation's number one killer, but also the state of Missouri's and this region's number one killer to be less prominent? And so, the things that I think have really, really been effective. Let's tout the concept of Heart Month. And last Friday was the 10th anniversary of the American Heart Association's Go Red for Women Day. And within those 10 years, if you start looking at just focusing on women, that event has done tremendous, tremendous things with respect to getting not only physicians, but also women to understand that cardiovascular disease is highly prominent in women, and it needs to be looked at, looked for, and treated appropriately. And within those 10 years, the incidence of coronary heart disease has not necessarily gone down, but the death rate has gone down within those 10 years. And so we're finding it, and we're able to do things with it. And that, and unfortunately, you have to look over the course of 10 years to start seeing kind of statistics like that. Within the past year, the things that have come out, you know, there's amazing and exciting things right along the horizon. I think Andy would agree with me with respect to our ability to treat high blood pressure in a way that we haven't been able to do before with a catheter-based technique. That's right around the corner. Our ability to treat aortic valve disease in patients who otherwise couldn't have open heart surgery, that's here, and it's really taken hold now, and that's highly effective. Those are two highlights that I would point to.
The accelerator really seems to have been pushed relatively recently in the area of surgery and less invasive surgery.
Well, because patients want it. No patient that I'm aware of wants to sign up to have the big open heart procedure. So, and doctors right. feel the same way. We're no different. If we would have to have a procedure, we wouldn't want to have the big open one unless that was the best way.
And I think, yeah, as Mike alluded to, we're learning more and more about this catheter-based approach to aortic valve surgery, less invasive mitral valve surgery, and even coronary bypass surgery. And we're learning more about it really on a daily basis.
Let's explain for our audience who may not fully understand what catheter-based surgery really is. Right.
So traditional aortic valve surgery would involve open-heart surgery, median sternotomy to open up the chest and replace the aortic valve. What has emerged in at WashU, I think we've done over 200 procedures now with what's called catheter-based or transcatheter-based aortic valve implantation, aortic valve replacement. It involves placing a catheter up either the femoral artery or going through the apex of the heart to place a catheter to place a valve in the aortic valve position, as opposed to, again, the traditional surgery.
Can all bypass surgeries now be handled this way, or do we still have to open the chest, spread the rib cage, and
so this,
go in?
This is a great debate. And, you know, the concept between one being completely replaced and somebody winning and somebody losing, you know, that's the American way. We want a winner or a loser. I think to shortcut that answer and to try to keep it as simple as possible, there is no clear-cut winner across the board. Bypass surgery is a great operation for particular patients with particular blockages in arteries who have other risk factors. And we've learned more and more about that over the past year. Two big studies have been released which have shown the benefit of bypass surgery. Obviously, everybody wants a stent, and the stent is similar to what Andy was just talking about from a valve standpoint, but we can put a tube in. We use the wrist. Other people use the leg artery, and we can open up blockages with those stents, and that's the preferred choice from a patient standpoint, but we have to make sure that we're offering the right thing for patients individually.
And just to be sure that everyone is clear on what a stent is, it's something that simply opens up the artery,
yeah,
correct,
and
allows the easier flow.
It's a wire mesh device. Looks very similar to the spring on your ballpoint pen there. If you take that apart and you got that, and we implant that in the artery, and that keeps the artery open to allow blood flow to get to the heart muscle tissue so that the heart muscle can work better.
Dr. Cates, you looked like you wanted to say
something.
No,
I was just saying it's interesting because we are learning more and more about the benefits of different procedures for treating cardiovascular disease, heart disease, stroke, peripheral vascular disease. But we're also learning, though, more is the importance of prevention, of the amount of money that we spend after these diseases have occurred. We're learning more and we know more about the importance of potentially spending money before the diseases occur. And this is where, of course, the issue of prevention becomes so important. And then the idea of spending the money up front may save us a lot of money down the road.
That's actually where I had intended to start. We put the cart before the horse here on talking about the surgeries. But prevention, obviously, is something we really want to stress on today's program.
The surgeries are the sexy thing, right?
Right?
But they do cost a lot of money, and they are very effective for certain people. But prevention is twofold, right? So if you have heart disease now, we want to prevent it from becoming worse, prevent you from being symptomatic from it, prevent you from having bad things from it. And we have a lot of great data with respect to doing that. And in fact, it's not just bypass surgery and stenting as the one versus two kind of Super Bowl of how to treat patients, but medical therapy with respect to taking about five or six medications in combination in many patients is just as good as bypass surgery or stenting, if not better. And definitely cheaper.
I would have to say, as a member of the Zipper Club, that I didn't find anything very sexy about it. But that's another story. Yeah. Go ahead, Dr. King.
No, I was going to agree. And what Mike says is absolutely right, too, that people sometimes discount the benefits of secondary prevention, as Mike said. So once you have coronary artery disease, actually treating those risk factors that caused it and trying to prevent the secondary event. But the other important thing, of course, is preventing the first event from happening.
Let's talk about who is most vulnerable and then what they can do to decrease that vulnerability. Who is? You mentioned women, doctor, and that is a relatively new phenomenon, is it not, that so many women are suffering from heart disease?
Well, certainly the publicity surrounds many other medical conditions that women can get that they're highly attuned to. A lot of it has to do with breast cancer and things that happen at earlier ages. But when you look at the statistics, and we did many years ago as a cardiology community, the number of women with coronary artery disease and heart disease at the age of 65 to 70 exceeded the number of men. And we say, whoa, what's going on here? We thought this is a disease of men, and it's not. It just develops a little bit later. The symptoms are a little bit different and a little more vague. And so that was what I was alluding to earlier with respect to the awareness campaign that the Go Red campaign really brought about. But the people who are vulnerable, they're not just women, they're not just men. It is our society, and some of the things are actually pretty scary. So we talk about the optimistic part. Let's talk about the pessimistic part. We're a much more inactive society in general, whether we're talking about adults or we're talking about children. We have much higher weights with respect to how much we weigh than we did before. We have much higher rates of diabetes. We have much higher incidence of high blood pressure. And smoking hasn't gone down. And these are the things, if Andy or I are both going to write down like in a list of what makes somebody vulnerable, these are the main things. So diabetes, obesity, inactivity, smoking, high blood pressure, these things are still there and they're actually increasing in prevalence. And so that's kind of the scary part.
And Dr. Cates, we are reading every day about obesity in children. So I guess that gets this whole process off to an early start.
Absolutely. I think we talked about this last year as well, too, the epidemic of obesity in children. That's wonderful. That Mike brings up some great points, though, as far as these risk factors that we see. And so many of the risk factors are treatable or modifiable. I mean, there's family history that people get concerned about in aging, two things which you can't really control.
Unfortunately.
Well, as they say, with aging, it beats the alternative, right? Mm-hmm. So, but there are so many modifiable, treatable risk factors. Now, Don, you brought up the issue of obesity in children, and you're absolutely right, the epidemic of obesity in children, and we know, of course, that obesity in children predisposes them to developing diabetes, this issue of something called the metabolic syndrome. We also know there's a study that came out recently called the Cardia study that looked at healthy young adults and showed that healthy young adults with several specific risk factors, the absence of these risk factors predicted that they'd be healthy middle-aged adults. So we know that if you exercise, if you maintain a healthy body weight, if you don't smoke, if you drink alcohol in moderation, things like that, if you have these healthy lifestyles early on, you're going to grow up to be a healthy adult too.
Before I take a break, when we speak of exercise, what are we talking about? I mean, we're not all going to play in the Super Bowl. We're not going to throw the discus, 200 yards or whatever.
So when it comes to exercise, there are recommendations for healthy adults. And certainly for people that are listening who aren't healthy or have cardiovascular disease already or other issues, they should talk with their physician before they take up an exercise program. But the recommendations for healthy adults would be moderate intensity exercise at least 5 days a week and 30 minutes a day. Moderate intensity simply is where you feel a little bit short of breath when you exercise. You want to get your heart rate up appropriately, but this is also in addition to daily activity. So we'll see patients, I'm sure Mike is like this too, you see patients who say, well, I don't exercise, but I'm active, meaning they walk a little bit at work or they take the trash out. That's not exercise. Exercise is specific physical activity intended for physical fitness. And so five days a week, 30 minutes a day.
But you don't have to join a health club to do this.
No, I recommend actually being the greatest window shopper in the world. So, all of our malls are open before, before hours, after hours, or even during hours. We have big box stores like the Walmarts and the Home Depots and the Lowe's. You walk in and you can go just keep walking through there for 30 consecutive minutes, and that's exercise.
I do have to take this break, but I just want to point out that I've been seeing devices where you count your steps, a pedometer. They're saying 10,000 steps is what you should do every day, and that's heart healthy.
Yeah, and we just started an initiative at WashU, tread the med, I think is the term, and just different paths to walk around for our employees to walk around the campus and with pedometers being distributed. And 10,000 steps gets you to that typically be 30 minutes of exercise. So it's a great idea.
Okay, we'll come back and continue our conversation. This is National Heart Month, and we are talking about heart health and prevention. And if you unfortunately do suffer from some sort of heart disease, the kinds of things that could be done to alleviate the situation for you. My guest in studio, Dr. Andrew Cates. He's a cardiologist with Washington University's Heart Care Institute and WashU Cardiology Fellowship Program Director. Dr. Michael Lim, also with a cardiologist, co-director for Comprehensive Cardiovascular Care at St. Louis University Hospital. Welcome back. Continue our conversation, and we'd certainly like to get you in on it. If you have questions related to heart health, give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on air. and you can also reach us through Facebook. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our discussion on heart health. My guests in studio, Dr. Michael Lim, cardiologist, and he's associated with St. Louis University Hospital and SLU Care. Also with me in studio is Dr. Andrew Cates, cardiologist with Washington University's Heart Care Institute. Been reading a lot lately about inflammation and heart disease. The articles have pointed to such things as psoriasis and other things, gout, as being either a contributing factor or a symptom. What is there to that, Dr. Lim?
Yeah, so the you know, to bridge on what Andy was just talking about from a standpoint of good lifestyle for a long time, I think that is part of the answer to this, and that is that as we are inactive and potentially eat the wrong things and smoke and do things, you know, that actually the body reacts to that. And the body reacts to that by having more inflammation potentially, and that inflammatory process puts cholesterol basically inside of the artery walls that supply blood to the heart. But also, you know, the arteries to the heart are not any different from the arteries to the rest of the body. So cholesterol can go in any of those arteries. Certainly if they go to the ones to the heart, then they end up potentially causing heart attacks, potentially getting you in the zipper club later down the road. But, you know, so inflammation is part and process of the process of coronary artery disease or atherosclerosis, which is in general anything that happens in any of the arteries. The exciting stuff is over the past year, Andy's read it and I've read it, is some medications that we would have never thought before. You mentioned gout. So gout medicines like colchicine, which really work on a completely different avenue, but work on this inflammation concept. Actually, people who take low-dose colchicine who have coronary artery disease turn out to have fewer heart attacks. Completely out of the box. I'm pretty sure that if you asked Andy that last year, what do you think about taking colchicine? He says, well, I don't know. There's no data for that, and so that can't be recommended. But that's come out this past year, and that's something that we have to pay attention to is new treatments and new pathways into this inflammation process, which is ongoing.
This is what I would call an unintended consequence, but a positive one. Dr. Cates, we've been hearing also about the unintended positive consequences of statins, which many people...
Well, and actually, this goes along the way of inflammation as well, too, mm-hmm. that, you know, statins are very important drugs and very beneficial drugs for lowering cholesterol, so lowering the LDL, the bad cholesterol, and innumerable trials have demonstrated that. But we've also found, though, there are other beneficial effects of statins. The term they use is pleiotropic, which really just means other effects. But one of those effects is anti-inflammatory. So there's been several studies looking at a biomarker called CRP, which stands for C-reactive protein. It's a protein that the liver makes. But we can measure that protein in the setting of measure protein in patients' blood, but we can look to see at certain levels, if that's elevated, that suggests increased risk for cardiovascular disease. And we know that statins can actually lower that CRP level as well. And so that goes along the lines, again, of an anti-inflammatory effect. And statins also potentially have an antithrombotic effect, so they can potentially prevent clots from forming and other benefits too. And statins have other benefits too, potentially in the setting of Alzheimer's disease and other conditions as well. So
yeah, I think people should be popping Lipitor or whatever as a preventive rather than waiting for the worst-case scenario.
That's another discussion. But no, I think there are definitely benefits to those medications, and we see patients a lot who are somewhat hesitant to take drugs, prescribed drugs like statins, yet they're far more willing to take dietary supplements. And something that's probably worth touching on is this issue of dietary supplements. It's been in the news quite a bit lately, be it with fish oil or multivitamins or even calcium. And that's something that's come up. And, you know, fish oil one of the interesting things, if we look back, a lot of the guidelines or recommendations potentially for dietary supplements relate to these observational trials that suggested that patients did better with certain foodstuffs, say, again, like eating fish. And that led to the benefits of omega-3s. But recent studies suggest that maybe fish oil supplements in themselves may not be specifically beneficial, that it's really the diet itself that may be a benefit.
We had a gerontologist on a couple of weeks ago saying exactly that, and basically was poo-pooing the effectiveness of certain vitamins.
But this is the whole thing, right? So we're talking about – we can talk about the benefits of individual medications or new things that come out which show a benefit. But the – and we would like to, as people, sort of find instant or quick fixes. So can I take a pill for that? Can I make it better? How can I make this quickly better or take my risk of a heart attack down several fold? And the problem is that it's not any one thing. It's not whether you drink grape juice, red wine, fish oil, or some other flaxseed oil. There's a lot of studies or a lot of observations which point to the benefit of any one of those things. But the real answer is the one that none of us want to hear, and that is it's hard, and we have to do it every day, and we have to be active. We have to eat a more healthy lifestyle type food. We can't go to drive-through windows. I mean, the easiest thing I start with my patients, they say, you know, I need a little help, and, you know, what should I eat? And I say, well, let me start with the low-hanging fruit. If it's got a drive-through window, don't go there. It's not good for you. There's no place with a drive-through window that serves or will give you a heart-healthy meal. And so you exercise and you eat lower in saturated fat. You get rid of fried food. You don't smoke. You treat your blood pressure and you eat a blood pressure-appropriate diet. And that's hard. But I go back to the concept of, you know, we wouldn't brush our teeth on a daily basis if our parents didn't make us do it when we were kids. So when we were kids, or with your kids or with your grandkids, you know, it's time for bed and you say, you know, did you brush your teeth? And they say yes. And you look at them and say, did you really brush your teeth? No. Okay, go do it. Okay. And so you do that for some kids a year, for other kids 20 years. But sooner or later they get it. And that becomes habitual. And the concept with respect to, I think, the real answer for prevention of heart disease and for us to make a real dent in it is to really make these things that we are talking about all habitual.
We've had Michael Pollan as a guest on this program, Dr. Cates, and you know who he is, I would guess. He's the food guy who basically tells us we should eat a lot of greens. But one of the things he says is if you buy a food product and you don't recognize the names of the contents of that product, or more specifically, if your grandmother would not recognize the names of what's inside, avoid it.
And it's interesting, you know, and grandma maybe cooked a lot of Crisco, though, and so we have made some advances over those years, years in understanding just what constitutes a heart healthy diet. But really, you know, I think this partly leads to the fact that patients or people don't really get the idea of what constitutes a healthy diet, although some of it really just makes sense, right? I mean, you know that the fried food is bad for you. You know that high calories are bad for you. And this is where I think it's getting away from a little bit of what you said, but the idea of labeling food with calories, calorie content, I think really goes a long way to making people aware of just how important calorie contribution is to obesity. As far as, you know, knowing what's on the label or not, it's true that the healthier foods are food are ingredients that we would recognize, and processed foods tend to be less healthy. But I think it is good advice to make sure you read the labels and understand what you're seeing. There's one thing I did want to touch on, though, and things that come to mind, though, people who do want to take supplements, is just remembering there was a study that just looked at multivitamins, the physician health study, that showed that taking a vitamin a day really didn't reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease. And for some patients, actually presume that if they take these supplements or take a multivitamin, they maybe don't have to exercise or don't have to eat healthy. And that's the wrong message to send, too. And maybe it's what Michael would do, trying to shortcut the system, that there is no substitute for eating a heart-healthy diet, which is, you know, diet low in fats, you know, avoiding processed foods and things such as that.
Let's go to the phones. We have, not surprisingly, a number of people who want to get into this conversation. Let's bring them in, and we'll start with that. What appears to be a basic question from Press, calling from St. Louis. Press, go ahead, please.
I'm enjoying the show, gentlemen, and it's a pleasure to hear Dr. Cates. He treated my dad when my dad had a heart attack. One of the things that I found most intriguing was that sometimes it doesn't manifest itself in a typical aspect what I thought it would be, you know, chest pains, but this was more gastritis. And I was wondering if they could touch on some of the different symptoms that would prompt someone to go to the hospital and get checked out. Because my mom went through a series where we thought and then found out that it wasn't, but it just didn't manifest itself through the typical, I've got a tight ball in my chest and feel like someone is sitting on it, but more of an upset stomach. I enjoyed the show, and thanks a lot, Dr. Casey, for your service.
Thanks, Chris.
With my dad.
My pleasure. Tell your dad I said hello.
Okay.
So, Chris, you bring up a great point, and this is something that we definitely should talk about, knowing what the symptoms are. So, you know, we've talked about heart disease prevention, but what we haven't talked about is what to do if you think you're having a heart attack. And the classic symptoms, which are still the most common, would be chest tightness or chest pressure that doesn't go away. And those are the symptoms of a heart attack. But it doesn't have to be that. It can be chest tightness. It can be, some people describe an elephant sitting on their chest or pain that radiates up to their neck. It can be associated with nausea or vomiting or sweating, things like that. Importantly, if you do think you're having a heart attack, don't drive to the emergency room. You need to call 911. And the reason why that's so important is that you get seen more quickly, for starters, when you get to the emergency room. But more importantly is the EMTs can assess you. They can do an EKG. They can see if you are having a heart attack or not. They can potentially institute therapy on the way there. They can have the ER ready to see you. And again, I guarantee you're going to get seen a lot more quickly coming in via ambulance than coming in by car. But most importantly is that many people who have a heart attack die suddenly, and they die from a heart rhythm problem. And if that happens while you're driving your car, you're not going to make it to the emergency room on time. But if it happens in the ambulance, they can treat you.
Let me just add one sec to that, because I think this is the biggest mistake that we see, is that people don't call 911 with symptoms. Mm-hmm. And a sudden onset of trouble breathing could be also a heart attack without any kind of chest pain or chest discomfort. Upper abdominal pain sometimes is a heart attack. I mean, the listener kind of put some of those out there. Unfortunately, there's no clear-cut definition. What I think is the definition is, you know, something's going on. You don't feel well, and it happens rather quickly. And you should pay attention to that. We've just went forward on I've spent the better part of the last 3 or 4 years with my partners within the region here to institute a system of care for people with heart attacks and strokes in this area. We have 18 hospitals in this area that can take care of a patient with a heart attack by getting a patient quickly to a heart catheterization lab and opening up those arteries. And we have provided a plan within the St. Louis region now to EMS to be able to get people to those places appropriately. What we really need is people to trust that EMS is going to do that, and I think there's every reason that they should do that.
Backing up just a second with regard to symptoms, we talked about women early on, Dr. Lim. Their symptoms can be quite different than men's.
Most of the time, their symptoms, not necessarily of an acute heart attack, what we just covered, but their symptoms of a more chronic condition is oftentimes breathing difficulties, oftentimes lack of energy for no better reason. And they say, well, you know, I'm getting older. And I remind them, well, you know, that actually is the goal. So we don't necessarily want to blame everything on what we're really trying to achieve. And so those are pretty vague symptoms of I just don't have the energy that I used to have. And that could be one of those things.
Yeah. And that's where knowing if you're at risk for heart disease is important too. So remembering the risk factors of hypertension or diabetes or smoking or family history and such is important in realizing if you're at risk.
We have a call from Richard here who wants to bring up one of the things that people can do to check themselves out, I believe. Richard, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Don. This is for one of the things Dr. Cates said about getting testing on a treadmill. And my question was this. If a person, is over 65, and he goes and gets a treadmill test, I mean the complete treadmill test, such as the one I had actually at Washington University, Barnes West, where they will hook up EKG wiring, measure breathing, elevate the treadmill, have people supervising you on the treadmill up to your maximum heart rate. That's very useful, but it's rather expensive on your insurance bill. And if you want to repeat it, say at a health club on a treadmill, are there some using a blood pressure monitor? Do you have some guidance on how a person can do that, say do it every 6 months, and even though it's not an official clinical test, just do it for back to maximum at 30 minutes, and then take the results in and discuss it with your doctor without having to go into a clinic and pay the insurance and all that?
So you bring up multiple great points. So thank you for the call. And let me see if I can remember to talk about all the great things you just brought up. So I think the main point you're alluding to is, well, I really want to get a test because we're kind of preconditioned to a concept of like early detection of cancer really improves somebody's survival. So can I get a test to see, do I have heart disease now? Because if I got it now, let's get it treated and that type of thing. And this brings up one of, unfortunately, our limitations in cardiology and cardiac care is that there is no one great perfect test to be able to really say that you are scot-free clean or that there's no real other things going on. We utilize testing in combination with symptoms and risk factors, and it's not any one of those in isolation. So you described a treadmill stress test. I'm sorry your insurance company billed you a lot of money for that, but I guarantee you that is the cheapest test you could have had done with respect to all of the stress testing that we could have done. And that is one that we utilize to evaluate symptoms or risk factors to evaluate your risk for potential heart attack down the road. And if that risk is higher, then we look for potentially adding things like medications, potentially aspirin or a class of medication like a beta blocker or a statin we talked about earlier to try to reduce your risk of a heart attack. But it doesn't necessarily tell you I have coronary artery disease or you don't have coronary artery disease. It tells you you have risk. And so the best thing that you can do on an ongoing basis is not necessarily want to repeat a stress test every year, every 6 months, and that type of thing. But back to what we were talking about earlier, go to your health club, get on your treadmill, and exercise, and pay attention to your symptoms.
Go ahead, Dr.
No, I agree. And the benefit, as Michael alluded to, the benefit of a stress test, though, is it does give us information as far as what your risk is. And there's ways that we can determine, even if you have symptoms, we can determine what your risk is of having a heart attack over the next several years may be. But it does give us additional information. I would encourage people, though, if you are concerned about cardiovascular risk, not to do your own stress test in a gym. You know, with a stress test that you have done at a physician's office, you're monitored. They're looking at your EKG, looking at your blood pressure response and your heart rate. So there's more to it than just simply getting on the treadmill and exercising. But as Mike said, the longer term thing is really just to continue to exercise.
Just to personalize this, I took a stress test a couple of years ago, failed it, and within 24 hours I was on the table. I mean, it probably saved my life by taking that test. So as you indicated, Dr. Lim, it can be a very profitable thing to do in so many different ways.
Cost effective
is the term I was looking for. Have to take another break now. Before I do that, I would like to alert our audience to the fact that we'll be making a special programming announcement at the end of this program, so stay tuned for that. I think it's information that you will like to have and information that we are proud to present to you. We'll do that in just a moment. Then we'll continue our conversation on heart care, heart health with Drs. Lim and Dr. Cates. Back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation on heart health. I'm going to go right to the phones because we have some folks waiting. Our number, 382-8255. If you'd like to join the conversation, send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet. We'll also are reachable through Facebook. But let's bring in Stan calling from St. Louis. Stan, thank you so much for waiting.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm 70 years old, and I've been hypertensive, well-controlled for many years. I eat a real healthy diet, and I do work out 5 days a week on a treadmill as well as weights. And I had an AFib episode a few years ago, and I was put on propafenone and haven't had an AFib episode since then. I'm wondering if I could ever titrate off of that propafenone, and if so, how I could do that.
Well, Stan, you ask an interesting question, and you know, when it comes to individualized care, I always encourage you to talk to your cardiologist who's taking care of you because he or she probably has put a lot of thought into it. You know, propafenone is one of those medications that can be very effective for treating atrial fibrillation and treating the heart rhythm itself rather than just treating the heart rate. You know, as far as whether or not you can come off it, again, it depends on so many different factors. I encourage you. I'm going to kind of hedge on this the best I can and say talk with your doc. Sometimes the medications can be stopped with a low risk of recurrence, and sometimes they can't be, but it just depends so much individualized for you and what other factors that you have playing into it.
But Stan, you bring up a great point for everybody else who's listening. We haven't talked about arrhythmias or atrial fibrillation, and atrial fibrillation clearly is the most common arrhythmia that's out there, and that's most frequently felt by people feeling like their heart rate is irregular or jumping around or skipping. And this arrhythmia actually is rather benign from a heart standpoint. Certainly it can cause some damage over the long term, but the big thing we worry about from a standpoint of atrial fibrillation is somebody's risk for a stroke with this rhythm. I would like to try to make sure that people are more aware of their heart rhythms and try to seek out and push their doctors to make sure that they're getting the appropriate therapy to prevent stroke, because we haven't talked about stroke. It is part of cardiovascular disease, and it's a devastating disease.
And one thing actually, that as Mike brought this up, it made me think too. You ask about stopping medications too. With AFib, there are factors that contribute to atrial fibrillation as well, like hypertension, sleep apnea, things like that. So potentially for patients who are out there who get these factors treated, then you may not be condemned to long-term medical therapy. But as Mike alluded to, absolutely with AFib, one of the main concerns is the risk of stroke and the importance for many people of being on appropriate blood thinners to prevent that stroke.
Didn't I read, Doctor, that there is now a surgery for AFib, I think, in some of the information that came with you?
So we have a lot of great treatments for atrial fibrillation, and it's hard to actually tell where Stan sits, but it sounds like he's not really bugged by it that much. So these are not the types of patients like him that we would offer the higher end treatments for atrial fibrillation. The higher end treatments we offer for atrial fibrillation are for two groups of people. One, the people who are highly symptomatic from it, meaning that their heart function goes down and they develop heart failure symptoms from it. Or the people who are just they don't feel right. They can't exercise. They can't get along with their daily life because their heart rate's too fast. And we can offer procedures either by a catheter, like we talked about before, which are an ablation type procedure, which actually has a chance of getting rid of atrial fibrillation or curing it. We can offer procedures through a camera in the chest called a mini maze, which does a similar kind of thing, or a combination of the two. So there's a lot of different potential there.
Okay. Thanks, Stan, for your call, and we hope that information was helpful to you. Let's now bring in someone who's been here a long time. That's Kathy in University City. Kathy, thanks for being so patient.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a small dog, which I walk at least twice or three times a day for 30 to 40 minutes. She's not a fast walker. She's small. And I was told by a doctor I couldn't count that toward an exercise regimen. Now, I guess my question is, do you have to feel your heart pounding before walking can be an effective exercise?
Well, that's a great question. I don't know the data to say that the size of the dog really matters as far as your ability to exercise. And what I would tell you, and I encourage patients when they do exercise, is to monitor their heart rate, and it's easily done. With a simple heart rate monitor you can buy at your local store without plugging any store in particular. But buy a heart rate monitor, a little chest band on it, and a wrist monitor. And just watch your heart rate, and you'd like to get it up to a certain level. And the American Heart Association has some recommendations for achieving about 70% to 75% of your maximum predicted heart rate to at least see some cardiovascular benefit. And I would tell you to watch your heart rate, to try to get up appropriately, and feel again where you're short of breath. And you can do that again with a dog, I think, regardless of the size of your dog. And some of those little dogs have a lot of pep too, right? So.
But the great thing is you're active and you're doing this multiple times a day. So, again, everything can be looked at from two different sides of the table. And I encourage you to continue to stay as active as possible. It sounds like you're doing the things that are right.
Get yourself a Jack Russell and you'll be running everything at twice the normal speed.
That's right.
Well, it would count toward weight-bearing on your bones, right? I mean, that would still not change, correct, no matter how fast you go?
Absolutely.
Right.
Kathy,
thank you so much.
Thank you for the call. Let's bring in Mike, another caller from University City. Go ahead, Mike. Mike, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm a 26-year-old male, obviously, and I was diagnosed with hypertension when I was 18 and put on lisinopril, and I've been well managing it ever since. And I was told I have a family history of heart disease. Both grandparents died real young. And I was told that lisinopril, even if you manage your blood pressure through lifestyle changes, that it can lower your risk of heart disease. And I just wanted to know if there's any truth to that, if staying on the drug, even if you don't need to, is a good thing with that kind of history.
Well, this is a tough one because, again, we get back to a similar question that Andy took a little bit earlier. And every patient and medication patient type decision should be always done with direct consultation with your physician. So we're going to have to try to extrapolate this and make it a little more general, because I don't want to give you a concept of whether you should stay on a lisinopril or take it off. But there's two different things that we recognize in some of our medications. One of them is, of course, they do what we want them to do. So blood pressure lowering medications lower blood pressure. And certainly with you being young, we want you to have a normal blood pressure. And unfortunately, it's likely not going to go down or stay down on its own for the long term. So you may need medications, whether it's lisinopril or something else, for quite a while. But we talked about statins having what Andy called pleiotropic effects before, and other medications we know also have benefits. And unfortunately, some of the times we only know those benefits exist once you have had something. You've had a heart attack, you have coronary artery disease, you've had a stroke, and then you take a medication similar to lisinopril or a few others where that makes it less likely that you're going to have another one. And so those are maybe some of the benefits that you've been hearing from a standpoint of lisinopril. But with respect to your individual question about should you stay on this medication or not and all those things, please have that conversation with your doctor.
You know, one thing to follow up on, with hypertension, that is one of those conditions that potentially patients with specific risk factor and lifestyle changes, they may be able to get their blood pressure better controlled. And so, for Mike, for somebody like yourself, if you are overweight, if you have other health problems like sleep apnea, many times controlling those specific risk factors may help lower your blood pressure to such a degree, at least, that you can have the conversation of getting off that medication. That and, you know, watching your dietary sodium intake as well can be beneficial. And, again, looking for those modifiable risk factors may, again, put you in that category where your blood pressure may get better controlled, to at least discuss potentially stopping the agent.
What about the side effects of some medications? And, again, I'm thinking of statins. There is someone in this building who is on Lipitor but has unilaterally cut the dosage in half because of body ache.
Yeah, and so we see that in patients. And depending upon the studies that we look at, typically about 10% of patients who take statins may have muscle aches. Now, there's a whole continuum of muscle symptoms, be it muscle aches or myalgias or myositis, which is actually an inflammation, or another condition called rhabdomyolysis, which is much more significant muscle damage. Again, about 10% of people may have muscle aches, and many times those symptoms can be either attributed to other conditions, or if they're attributable to the statin, can be controlled either by cutting the dose in half or potentially switching to a different statin with alternative dosing. This is where I think it's important to talk with your physician as well, to make sure, simple blood test to make sure there's no muscle damage, but then again, alternating or again, adjusting the medication appropriately. Most people tolerate it just fine, and the vast majority do. Other patients do get worried about issues regarding liver toxicity or liver failure with statins, which we now know is just not true. There's a recent, or about a year ago now, that the FDA came out with an updated guidelines, if you will, recommendations regarding statins, really removing the need for periodic liver testing to be done for statins, because they just don't really cause liver failure.
Sure. Well, the key, yeah. I think one of the keys of what you've just said is the fact, if you're going to cut your statin in half, check with your doctor before you do it unilaterally.
Right.
And every medication has a potential side effect. And so this is why we are trying to kind of punt specific medication patient questions to your doctor, because that's exactly where it should take place. And there's issues with respect to what the benefit is versus what the potential side effect is and how that weighs out. And that's different for every individual person. Cost is very, very important. The good thing with respect to the two medications that have been named here, propafenone and lisinopril, they're amongst the cheapest out there. So I'm proud of our colleagues that are prescribing the generic, less expensive medications that are equally effective.
And they are equally effective. That should be point. Some people are afraid of the generic, thinking it's lesser somehow. Let's go back to the phones and bring in Adam calling from St. Louis. Adam, if you hadn't asked this question, I would have, but go ahead.
All right. Well, my grandfather has had several heart attacks. I think he's had three. He's 74 years old. And a long time ago, before he was actually diagnosed with heart disease, he had heartburn, which doctors have now called mini heart attacks. I'm a 21-year-old male. I exercise about 4 to 5 times a week. What is it that I can do to not get heart disease, not get heart attack, being that it is heretic, and my uncle is following in the footsteps and has had a heart attack already at the age of 57.
Great. Adam, I mean, you bring up a great question, and again, thanks for asking it. You know, it's important to realize, too, when it comes to risk related to family history of coronary artery disease or cardiovascular disease, it's important to understand what we consider to be a risk factor. And it's really premature coronary disease, which is traditionally defined as a heart attack or coronary disease in a male first-degree relative, so sibling or parent, before the age of 55, or female relative before the age of 65. The reason why I say that is, I mean, we see patients who come into the office because of family history of heart disease, and their grandmother died at age 85 from a heart attack, and well, that's unfortunate, but that doesn't really increase the patient's specific risk. So it's worth identifying what we consider to be premature coronary disease as it affects the individual patient. And so it certainly sounds like you are somebody potentially who is at risk because of that. At age 21, I think it's certainly very early for you to presume that you may have coronary disease. And I know you didn't presume that, but what you are asking, which is the right question, is what can you do to prevent these other problems? Prevent the problems from happening. And this is where I think I alluded to a little bit earlier about a study that just looked at young adults living a healthy life, growing up to be healthy older adults. So things that you can do would be to, if you smoke, and I'm presuming you don't smoke. I hope you don't. Don't smoke. If you drink, then drink in moderation, which is defined really as 1 to 2 drinks per day. If you don't exercise, you need to, and it sounds like you do exercise appropriately, making sure your blood pressure stays well controlled. And again, those healthy lifestyle changes are important. That's the best thing that you can do. There are screening modalities that are out there looking for other potential risk factors. We talked before about a CRP level. There's other screening modalities, including look at the thickness of your carotid arteries or potential calcium buildup in your coronary arteries. I think for you specifically, none of us would advocate those screening tests right now. It's not appropriate. Your risk right now is still very, very low. Again, it's these lifestyle steps that you should take that are most important.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the call. I'm going to try to get one more in the limited time we have. Tom in St. Louis, go ahead, but it's going to have to be fast.
I've got a question in general just on protocol. I was enjoying the discussion on the treadmill test. I had one a year ago, and they began the test. I'm 69. I was 69 at the time. They started the test at a 3% grade, and so it was a little more difficult than a flat beginning. After 3 minutes, I couldn't go on anymore. They graded me based on what I did complete and gave me a METS score of, like, I don't know, 6. Which was higher than anticipated, and because it was done at the VA, it resulted in a lower compensation. Because according to them, the lower your metabolic equivalency, the higher the compensation. Do you have any guides on the use of the protocol used for the tread test, whether you start at an elevation or flat?
Tom, thanks a lot, but we've only got 40 seconds to answer the question.
So, we might need a whole hour about treadmill testing. But but in general, you know, there are multiple pre-programmed testing modalities that we can program into the treadmill. That's up to the discretion of the physician that hopefully was guiding that. And, you know, I can't get too much into the specifics about this question because there's too many variables that are there, unfortunately.
Sure. We can't on radio programs answer everything, and we certainly can't do diagnosis or treatment. I have to stop it right there, gentlemen. Thank you so much. Dr. Andrew Cates of Washington University's Heart Healthcare Institute, thank you for being with us.
Pleasure.
And Dr. Michael Lim from St. Louis University Hospital, thank you so much for being with us. Most informative hour.
Thank you.
Good to see you. Good to see you. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll hear about the latest political news from Washington, D.C. and Jefferson City. We'll also get reaction and analysis of Illinois Governor Pat Quinn's State of the State address, which you can hear tonight at 7 o'clock on 90.7 KWMU.
Also, we are excited to announce a special St. Louis on the Air broadcast scheduled for Monday. St. Louis City voters go to the polls on March 5th to cast their ballot for the Democratic nominee for mayor. We invite you to attend the St. Louis mayoral primary forum right here in the community room of our new home, Umselet Grand Center. Incumbent Mayor Francis Slay, Aldermanic President Louis Reed, and former St. Louis Alderman Jimmy Matthews will participate in this forum. I will moderate the discussion. We'll also have an opportunity for questions from you. Seating begins promptly at 10:30 and will be offered on a first-come, first-served basis. Again, that's a special broadcast of St. Louis on the Air, Monday at 11. More information is available on our website, stlpublicradio.org. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.